Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us today. I recently had the great pleasure of talking with Eduardo Cohn about his recent book, How Forests Think, Toward an Anthropology Beyond the Human. This came out in 2013 with the University of California Press. This book is grounded in a very rich, very deep, and a really wonderful ethnography of a particular village in Ecuador's upper Amazon. It uses that ethnography to both give a very detailed and a very pointed account of the context that Cohn is talking about, but also to open up much more broadly the way it's possible for us to think about and with non-human selves. Now, what that looks like will become clear in much more detail once you get to the course of the conversation, but it's really, I think, a tremendously important intervention in how we tend to think about and what we tend to assume about integrating non-human actors into our stories about science studies, our stories about the world. I love this book. It's been completely transformative for me. I've been teaching with it. I've been going back over and over the chapters since I first read it. It's really completely changed how I think about and how I work with selves, non-human entities, and notions of space and of being and of life and of death and the kind of material that I work with. It's also beautifully written. It's very moving. And it will give you ways of thinking about and thinking with dreaming and dreams, not just of people, but also of dogs and of other entities. It's a wonderful accounting of animals, of forests, of water, of people, of language. And it's just a beautiful and extraordinarily compelling, I think, and very challenging work. And so I hope you have a chance to read the book. I hope you enjoy it. And I hope you also enjoy the conversation. And I can't emphasize enough how much that I've really enjoyed both. I'm here today to talk with Eduardo Cohn about his awesome new book, How Forests Think, Toward an Anthropology Beyond the Human. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Eduardo, and thanks very, very much for making time to talk with me today about this book. I really loved it, and I'm really, really looking forward to it. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Carla, and thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Of course. So let's talk a little bit about yourself and your background as it pertains to the book. Specifically, you talk early on at the very beginning of the book about having a kind of a deep family connection to work and life in Amazonia, which is where the book is set. So what brought you to start at the very beginning of, which is probably a long process, what brought you to the anthropology of Ecuador's upper Amazon? How did you come to this broad field that you're working in today?
Well, my parents are children of European Jewish refugees who escaped the Holocaust and went to Ecuador. So many of my relatives live in Ecuador, and I was extremely close to my grandmother, who was an amateur archaeologist, and my grandfather, who was a pharmaceutical chemist, who was going into the Amazon. So I would spend a lot of time with them when I was a kid, and I think that's basically how I got started. I actually met, as I mentioned in the book, I met the person who was going to be my PhD advisor when I was 12 in my grandmother's house. So I was there from very early on, and that's I started traveling into the Amazon and kind of got hooked, trying to figure out what's going on in this really complicated forest that was just very interested. I found it very interesting.
So why, given the fact that you had this kind of connection already early on with this area, how did you come to anthropology as a disciplinary home for exploring the kinds of issues you were interested in within that region?
Well, I guess I did get, obviously anthropology is about the study of people. And I think what I've always drawn me about, so, you know, I could have done it in many other ways, but, and in fact, there were, as I started getting more interested in tropical biology, there were a couple of biologists who were trying to recruit me to get me to do a PhD in tropical biology. And I realized that anthropology, as I knew it, was basically the field that would allow me to do the most kinds of things, because at a minimum, I could define my work based on any number of things that anyone was doing in the field. I later expanded that even further to kind of in some ways go beyond the human and anthropology itself through anthropology. But when I started doing research, I didn't really know about science studies or any other kind of framework that would allow this. So this seemed to me the best. But of course, I also am very committed to. I've always been very committed to anthropology through the method of ethnography, and the sort of insistence of really, really going deep into, say, learning languages and things like that. So my work was done in the field language, and I spent a lot of time doing sort of traditional ethnographic field work, which I'm still methodologically very committed to.
Mm-hmm. So the book itself, very, very briefly put, and we're going to go into lots and lots more detail about what this means and what the consequences and implications are. The book itself proposes, as you just alluded to, an anthropology beyond the human. So we'll talk in more detail about what that means and how it unfolds in the course of the book. But before we do that, to get us started, can you talk a little bit about how you came to that particular focus? So we've moved from the general area to anthropology or ethnography. As a kind of disciplinary or conceptual set of methodologies. So how and why the non-human or the beyond the human?
Well, I was always, as I just said, I was methodologically very drawn to ethnography. And of course, I have a deep commitment to, I've spent a lot of time with people in Ecuador, and I just have so there's a kind of a draw to anthropology for that reason, both methodologically and also in terms of the subject matter. But I always found it problematic that certain things, that things could only be talked about in terms of cultural construction or social construction or historical contingency. And that was always something that from the very beginning was an issue for me. And I had some sort of instinct even before I had sort of formulated it, that somehow interacting, doing ethnography with people who are doing something that doesn't only involve humans would be a way to get at this. But it was very, even when I was doing my dissertation, I didn't really have a clear framework for how this is actually going to work. I just knew that if I looked in this area and listened, something interesting was happening.
So did the project or how you were thinking about it, narrating it, constructing it, envisioning it, change in any kind of significant way from the dissertation stage to the manuscript stage? Were there any major transformations in that process that reshaped how you approached or thought about what you were doing in the book?
Yes. I mean, the dissertation, the project is the same. Most of the field work that I did for what is the book was done during the dissertation. But the dissertation and the book are completely different. I mean, I don't think there are probably more than a few paragraphs or sentences that are the same. And it changed a lot, largely by basically following much more carefully what things that were insights or hunches about what was going on. Say in the dissertation, I kind of focused on a few things. For example, this bizarre thing that comes up later on in chapter 4 about dog dreams and why dog dreams are different from human dreams or things like that. And these things, which I sort of was able to sort of identify as interesting problems and was able to sort of discuss the ethnography, I wasn't really able to fully get to the bottom of what was going on and what the implications were for what we were doing as anthropologists. So the book really allowed me to really kind of build over a very long period of time a much more sustained reflection on what was going on. And it is a slow book. The book, I was basically, it was, I was roughly about a decade in writing it after the dissertation. So it was really, it's a very special moment in my life. It was a kind of a funny parallel universe. One, of course, was the actual ethnographic work, which I spent 4 years in Ecuador doing. And the other was writing a book that, you know, if I were, which junior scholars are usually, you know, they usually under tremendous pressure to write quickly. And a first book is often something that's produced in a couple of years. In both cases, I've always sort of just, I've just sort of done my own thing with these things. And I'm, I have to say, I'm happy with the way that turned out.
So am I. It's an amazing book. I mean, I think it's the kind of, the thinking and the conceptual confidence and elaboration here just show the kind of maturity that most of us just don't have, frankly, a couple of years, 3-4 years out of the PhD. And so well worth the wait. I think this is really a field changing book in a lot of ways, and not just for anthropology, but particularly for STS as well. And I'm sure we're going to get to that. Mm-hmm. So the beginning of the book, to get right into it, introduces a moment that's going to, that we're going to see again and again unfolding over the course of the book. This is a moment where you explain a conversation where you were told, when were jaguars are around, sleep face up. So let's start here. Can you explain for listeners, especially listeners maybe who aren't familiar with this idea, what is a were jaguar? And in what way does this anecdote motivate, right at the beginning, the kind of work that you want to do in this part of the book?
Mm-hmm. Well, a were jaguar is sort of like a werewolf. It's a funny term. It's a shape-shifting jaguar, a jaguar that is also a person. And the point of that first anecdote is to sort of, in some ways, seduce the reader, or at least create a kind of a problem for the reader that is difficult to resolve within our intellectual framework as anthropologists or as humanists who are used to working through a form of argumentation by context or historical convention or culture or social construction. And the idea simply is that in the forest, and it doesn't matter so much that it's a were-jaguar, a person that is transformed to a jaguar transformed to a person. It's just the fact that in the forest, one has to interact with jaguars in certain ways. And basically because jaguars interpret the world in certain ways. And so it doesn't matter so much how it is that we interpret this. It's getting right how they interpret it. Basically, if you encounter a jaguar in the forest and you look back at the jaguar, it will treat you as a being like itself. If you look away, it will treat you as prey and attack you. And so the point here is simply that that there are other kinds of points of view out there, other ways of interpreting things, other ways of representing, and those aren't exactly human. And there are times when we have to get those things right. And if that's true, then all of a sudden, if it's true, for example, about the Runa, these Quechua-speaking Amazonian people that I was spending time with, then we to be faithful to what they're up to, we can't just use the analytical framework of anthropology, which is one that's based on some sort of version of an argument from culture. It doesn't need to be culture in the literal sense of, you know, their belief systems, their traditions, but it could be the ways of knowing that are in some ways historically contingent or socially given. This example of this encounter, or the potential of this encounter with this jaguar, shows that somehow there's an outside to that. there's a point of view and a form of representing that is not just from within. This is not just how the Runa think, jaguars think. One has to also attend to how jaguars think.
Mm-hmm. And actually, as we move, for listeners who might be surprised by even that way of phrasing the problem, right, how jaguars think, and the book itself, how forests think, as we move further into the book, the what it means to ask that question and to take it seriously and what it means to think in that context is part of what the book is all about. So right. As we sort of move into the book, the introduction, among other things, sets up the general problematics that we're going to see throughout the rest of the chapter. So it's devoted at the same time to rethinking, or as you put it, to opening the human and associated concepts, and also to rethinking the kind of anthropology that would be, as you put it, adequate to this task. So early on in the book, or in this introduction, you lay out some of the conceptual tools and the kind of touchstones that brought you to this way of thinking about these problems, including the work of Philippe de Escola, Eduardo Viveros de Castro, and this is something that's going to lead us into the first chapter, the world of Charles, or the world and the semiotics of Charles Peirce.
Right.
So the importance of Peirce and his notions and sort of opening up his concepts is something that each one of the chapters in some way really explicitly or implicitly engage with. And so let's get right into that because the first chapter really lays that out really nicely.
Okay.
So chapter one rethinks the relationship between human language and other forms of representation that humans share with non-human beings. It opens with this story about a peccary, a kind of pig, and a sonic image, tsupu. At least that's how I read it, tsupu.
Yeah, that's right.
And understanding what's happening with this peccary and why this or how this sonic image means really is going to open up a way of thinking about how you want to position a kind of ethnography of signs beyond the human. And this gets us into Peirce. So can you then maybe start us off in our exploration of this chapter by explaining what's happening with tsupu and what's important to understand about this in order to understand the larger point you're using this to make about signs and semiotics?
Right. So, yes. So the chapter asks you, lays out a little scenario. It's from a story. A young guy was recounting to me and someone else about hunting pigs. And a wounded pig falls into the water, and he describes this as tsupu. And so I have the reader guess what this means. And the point is that most people, when they try to guess this, the meaning of this, obviously, if they don't speak Quechua, they don't get it right. But the moment I tell them what it does mean, tsupu is a special kind of imagistic kind of word-like thing that means it's used to describe how an object penetrates and makes contact with and then penetrates a body of water. Tsupu. The moment I say that, and this is especially apparent like in a big lecture hall, you can hear people go, So I'm very interested in that question. It's like, how did that happen? Why do you say, why is that sense? How can you all of a sudden feel this sort of recognition for something that, you're not supposed to know? You don't speak the language, right? And so I take that little sort of tiny example as a sort of wedge into this larger question of representation, namely that the way that we think of representation comes from the way we're used to thinking of what we usually think of as that paragon of representation, which is the conventional sign or the arbitrary and conventional sign, or things like the word, the symbol. And my point is that virtually all of our thinking about either both representation and what is not representation, and this is not just, say, anthropology, but also much of, say, STS, is based on this assumption that somehow there's this completely radical break between a sign and its object, which is actually, in some ways, does accurately capture, a pure word as we usually think of it, the word that doesn't really have any connection to the thing it represents, other than its connection to other words in a kind of network of words. So just that little example, as again with the jaguar example in the introduction, is an image. It's a thought image this is the kind of thinking I like to develop. Let's think with this problem and try to figure out why it holds, what hold it has and what it can do. So I've been fascinated by tsupu even before, well before I knew about the existence of purse. And the way I try to think about this book, it's not so much, and I've been, you know, it's not so much, oh, Eduardo Cohn, he's doing this thing and he uses a Peircean framework. I mean, it so happens to be that I've stumbled on purse and I find it very productive. But I'm hoping that the reader will appreciate that I don't think it's that I'm applying purse to the forest, but I'm allowing the forest think itself through me. And I'm also using some of purse's tools to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really, at least for me, from the perspective of this reader, which is all I can speak from, that's really clear. And what's really important in how we understand, at least again from my perspective, with the work that's being done with tsupu and the larger point that you're making about signs, comes under the, or is really nicely encapsulated in this phrase you introduce in this chapter, provincializing language.
Yes, so yes.
This is really, right, do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because this seems really important. I mean, you're making the claim that signs are not just, this is not just something that operates in the human realm. And so yeah, can you talk about that?
My sense is that in some ways, I'm going to use extremely broad strokes here,
sure.
But in some sense, the birth of the social sciences or the human sciences, and I'm thinking back to someone like Durkheim, is based on what you could call a linguistic turn. Whether this is laid out in an explicit way or not, I don't think Durkheim was thinking about what he was talking about in terms of language, or whether it's laid out in a more explicit way, say, for example, with someone like Lévi-Strauss or earlier Boas. Social science, in some ways, and the humanities are based on an insight that much of what human reality is the product of what you could call very much language-like phenomena. So, for example, you could describe informal terms. I could say, I'm going to say something very jargony, but then I'll unpack it. There are many situations in which analytically we use a formula that's something like this, that a kind of what we're studying is the ways in which a relatum comes into being by virtue of its relationship to other such relata. Now that sounds very abstract, but let me just sort of play that out through a series of analytical frameworks. If you think of Durkheim, one of Durkheim's main points was to say, you can't understand a social fact or a social institution except by understanding it in terms of other social institutions that sort of sustain it, right? If you think about culture, the claim is that you can never understand some sort of cultural element in isolation. You have to understand it in terms of the larger meaning system. And you could say the same thing about a kind of Foucauldian genealogical analysis, or even the network of an actor network theory. All of these approaches, whether or not they are explicit or not about it, are taking a certain property of language, a relational property of language, which is which has to do with the ways in which, in a symbolic system, a symbol doesn't ever relate directly to its object. It relates to a set of relations among objects by relating to a set of relations among signs. That's a little bit awkwardly put, but the idea here is that we are often much of our analytical frameworks are basically taking an insight about relationality, which is drawn from the properties of language, and they hold true in many parts of our human lives, because we are linguistic creatures, and our minds are in some ways colonized by language. That's makes us who we are. But the point I want to make is that there's also something beyond that, and that beyond is something we have access to, and we need to learn how to think about that without constantly falling into thinking about everything as if it were language-like. So my call to provincialize language is to be much more explicit about what kinds of things have language-like properties and to recognize that and say, well, other things don't have language-like properties. So this word tupu, when I put words in scare quotes, isn't really a word. It doesn't fully have those language-like properties, even though it's sort of parasitic on language. It's sort of taken along and used in language. And that's sort of, in some ways, that's a really nice example of one of the ways in which even those things that seem so symbolic and language-like are actually reaching out into, are actually open to things that stand beyond it. And that's why that chapter is called The Open Hole. Somehow language creates a kind of a hole, like a complex hole, which was Tyler's famous definition of culture. But it's also open, and it's that opening that I'm quite in, that I want to study. That's the object and goal of this book. We know how closure works, and that of course was an important, hugely important contribution. But it's the opening that we need to work on now. Mm-hmm.
And before we move on from tsupu to barking, I'll just highlight for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, and I hope listeners go out and do so. Highly, highly recommend. But you mentioned two words that actually are explored in really wonderfully deep and open ways in the chapter, complex and relationality. Mm-hmm. And so the chapter actually pays a lot of attention to the importance of relationality, of habits, of patterns, of the mm-hmm. reality as such, and of the ways that these create not just holes, but complex holes. Mm-hmm. You consider at various points of the book complexity in terms of dynamic systems, right? And so this chapter, it's the word complex is not just beside the point, basically. It's not just incidental. I mean, what the symbolic representation is emerging out of a self-organizing dynamic system here.
So right.
It's really,
right.
I think that's really right. Interesting.
Yeah. Yes.
So, from tsupu to barking. So the second chapter, The Living Thought, opens with a moment that involves three barking dogs. And this moment is going to ask us to, or is going to allow us to explore the question, not just how do dogs think, but what does it mean to think? And by extension, what does it mean to be alive? And so can you talk a little bit about these three barking dogs? What's happening with these dogs? And what does this anecdote also open up in terms of the larger arguments that you're making here about thinking and about what it means to think and be alive? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So this anecdote was basically, it was an event that became a very important event in the lives of the people I was living with and also in my field work. And it happened probably a couple of years into the project. There were some people out in the household where I was living. Some people went out to harvest fish poison, and the dogs were trailing along. And we later learned they were attacked and killed by a jaguar. What this became a puzzle. What actually happened to these dogs was a huge puzzle, and was revealed through a variety of things. It forced them, people, to think how dogs were thinking. It forced them to pay attention to their own dreams and figure out what they were dreaming. It forced them to think about what their dogs might or might not have dreamt. So it became a very interesting thing. But the particular example that I start with has to do with a statement or a conversation that the women were having, and it has to do with imagining what the dogs failed to notice. How could they have gotten to a scenario where they attacked the dogs the way that the dogs did what they did? And it seems that from the barks that the women heard, that they thought that the dogs had tried to attack something that then attacked them. And they said, they got together and they're like, oh, you know, there's only one thing that could have happened. They must have confused a mountain lion with a deer. They must have thought that they were attacking a deer, which was actually a mountain lion. Now, this seems kind of preposterous, but it doesn't really matter for the point that I'm trying to make, which is simply that to imagine how a being thinks, one has to also imagine the productive, in the broadest of terms, the productive ways in which confusion is creates a kind of thought, creates a kind of a relationship. Mm-hmm. And and specifically, a kind of stupidity is a form of thinking. I often say that I try to provoke my anthropology students in my big introductory lecture classes that what I love about anthropology is that it's a flaky science and that I myself am a sort of a flake. And this is exactly the sort of thing that that intrigues me. How is it that at the heart of thinking, there is something that is not thought-like at all, that it's sort of essential. It involves a kind of confusion. And this is an introduction to one sort of theme that is extremely important throughout the book, which is this productive power of not noticing difference and the ways in which, although we tend to think of thought as based on difference, Saussure will say that at the heart of all semiology, its difference is the one thing that sort of organizes it all. That I think that there's actually something else much more counterintuitive at the heart of stuff, which is absence and confusion. And in some ways, the book, one of the larger arguments of the book is to sort of get at this weird counterintuitive property that is intrinsic to life.
Now, one of the, thank you for that, by the way, I'm you're really lost in thought, just based on what you just said, but let's come back so that we're not so lost. Or at least I'm not sort of lost in that moment. And I'll just mention the reason why I'm articulating that is that this is an example of many times when reading the book where I stopped and came away from it and really got launched into a completely new way of thinking and seeing. And this has happened. This happens throughout the book for the reader, at least did for me. And it's one of the reasons I really loved the book. But okay, back to selfhood. So you're showing in this chapter that selfhood is not just limited to animals with brains, and it's not just limited to humans. And this actually brings up a really important critique of contemporary STS. So you are critiquing in this chapter in a way that I think is very productive, the way STS tends to treat non-humans generically and really missing the distinction between selves on the one hand and objects or artifacts on the other. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that seems to me to be an extraordinarily important and productive critique.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, there's a certain part of STS, which can be in some ways captured through, you can think of a certain part of, say, Bruno Latour's career, although I think it's quite, I think that there are many parts of what he's up to, especially in his current project, the inquiry into modes of existence, where lots of different kinds of realities he's playing with, trying to figure out how to be true to and translate among lots of different kinds of realities. But there's a certain moment in STS that is responding to the same problem that I'm working with and others are, that somehow this social construction stuff is a real problem. That social construction in some ways creates two kinds of things. The reality out there that we can either say exists or doesn't, and the thing that we represent and create. And this is obviously a big problem. And so this sort of traditional STS, this actor network theory, is an attempt to somehow get beyond that social construction. But the way that it tends to be done is to somehow, through a kind of reduction. I mean, it's not called that. In fact, it's sometimes called irreduction, but it's effectively reduction in the sense that there's a kind of flattening, an ontological flattening. The way in which you create a relationship or you recognize relationships among different kinds of entities is to treat them as if they were the same kinds of entities. And so, yes, things and selves and objects and artifacts all get sort of are treated as the same kind of thing. Now, the problem is that that erases certain kinds of very real differences, and it also forces us often to account for certain sorts of relationships by sneaking in very human-like kinds of qualities back into the thing. So you get things that have very much thing-like properties and humans that acquire very much thing-like properties, but then the whole thing gets sort of motivated by certain kinds of intentions that seem extremely human. And that also requires a lot of linguistic dexterity from the point of view of the writer and humor, and I'm not so good at that. So, but yeah, that's the short answer to what I'm getting at. But self, what self is, I sort of try to get at what I think of sort of minimally. Part of what one of the strategies of this book is to show that things that we take, I guess in some ways our general way of looking at stuff is to say, okay, there's all this human stuff which we understand really well, like symbolic thought and language and culture and those sorts of things and ethics and power or whatever. And then there's this world of stuff out there that we kind of use some sort of kind of physics sort of understanding to understand how that works. So this is a sort of mind-body dualism. And part of my project is to sort of show that there's actually a whole bunch of these things that we kind of know from the sort of full-blown human examples, things like self or representation, actually have much more pervasive, simpler versions. And by simpler, this is not an ethical or I don't mean to pass judgment on it, but more pervasive, less hierarchical versions. So, and to understand that, once one appreciates that, then one can see how we humans are actually sort of related to many more kinds of things. So self, I'm very interested in saying, well, there are some very simple ways to think about what self and thought are, which wherever it is found will exhibit. And those things stand in continuity with the kinds of things that we do.
Mm-hmm. And you go on to show in the next chapter, staying with this theme of self and understanding what it is to be a self, that to be a self and to be an object are not necessarily two different kinds of things that don't coexist. And so chapter three considers the challenges and considers the issues involved in living as a self within an ecology of other selves. And specifically, you look at the relationships here of different kinds of selves living in this ecology in terms of life and death. So specifically, what does it mean to be a hunter that's simultaneously, right, aware of and respecting the fact that you are living in a web of relationalities with other selves and also killing some of those selves, right? Or, you know, and what happens when you die yourself? And so can you talk about that in terms of the work that this chapter is doing? This is a chapter called Soul Blindness, and it really explores sort of what happens in terms of the relationship between self and object when we bring death into life.
Yeah, so Soul Blindness is a really important chapter in the book in the sense that it's sort of, in some ways, I mean, the whole book is ethnographic, but in the chapters 1 and 2, I'm really laying out something about of an analytical framework, and in chapter 3 and 4 I really start to get into some sort of practical everyday problems that people face, and one is sort of the foremost here is how do you negotiate, how do you deal with the world in which you're so aware of the selfhood of all of the various beings that you're forced to hunt, and what kind of contradictions does that bring up? And in the process, I'm trying to get at, I guess, two things. One is, as you mentioned, and this is all will sort of come to fruition in chapter 6, in the final chapter, is the constitutive role of death in life. So, you know, you can't think of life without death. And the other has to do with sort of and it's something else which is sort of central to this book, which is thinking of our own psychic, our own psychic lives, and the fact that for us humans, this contradiction, this close link between life and death, is so difficult for us to wrap our heads around, our own mortality, you could say. And in some ways, hunters are dealing with this all the time. They have to. So it's sort of, this is where a place where sort of the ethnography kind of lays out some of the sort of what I called here following Cora Diamond, some of the difficulties of reality that we face as humans, sort of aware of this contradiction that just doesn't really make sense, how life is wrapped up with death, how death is wrapped up with life.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, I want to move on to the pigeons, but I want to just mention for listeners, there's also some really wonderful things going on in that chapter that consider just the physicality of fatherhood among in this context.
Yeah.
The figure of the predator, why so much of the experiences that you're relating here have something to do with a predator figure and predation.
Right.
And there's just a wonderful discussion of Cavell also, Cavell's work and his concept of little deaths. And so there's a
right.
lot. This is one of, you know, all of the chapters are like this. There's so much we could talk about in every single one of them. They're extraordinarily rich.
Go ahead. I was just going to say just a little add on that this, one of the things that's so interesting, I mean, there's something, this book is thought of as, I think of it as something general, and I want to say something general about how forests think. And part one of my ethnographic objects is generality itself. But there's something specific and very ethnographically particular about Runa ways and Amazonian ways of thinking about relationality through predation. And that's extremely well developed, is, for example, in the works of Eduardo Vivedo Zacastro. In fact, he's just written a book called Cannibal Metaphysics, which is sort of an exploration of this kind of ontology, Amazonian, Amerindian ontology of that involves predation. But it's also the ways in which that such a way of thinking about things or such an ontology actually has the possibility of eating or cannibalizing our very own philosophical frameworks. So predation sort of plays a really nice role in that. But yeah, it's just incredibly important ethnographically. That's sort of the sort of ecological relationship that many Amazonians are the most interested in.
Awesome. I'm going to go look up that book after we stop talking as well. So as we move here, you've mentioned several times already the dreaming dogs, right? The dogs' dreams. And as we move into the next chapter on trans species pigeons, we move into these dreams. Now, it's not only one of the beautiful things throughout the book, but certainly in this chapter, is that you're not just showing this kind of co-constitutive nature of life and death, but also within the experience of life and the being of life, wakefulness and dreaming are also both really, really important aspects of what it means to live and to be a self. And so dreams recur over and over again throughout the book. And at least in my experience, it really made me pay more attention in some ways to my own dreaming as a result of this.
Right.
So this chapter uses this notion of a trans species pigeon to think about the question of what does it mean to interpret the dreams of dogs, right? What does it mean to live with dogs, and how are dogs themselves pronouns. Right. Yes. I mean, dogs are really central to the life of the Runa in this book. And so you're really looking closely at what does it mean for a dog to survive in this context? And what does communication look like? And so can you talk a little bit about this idea of a trans species pigeon, specifically in the context of the dogs and the Runa they're living with? How does this work, and why is this, or in what way is this important to the kind of work that this chapter is doing?
Well, this chapter like the previous one, but even more so, is really, you know, I've, in some ways, I start the book out sort of moving away from the culture concept. And by culture, I mean things that have to do with historical contingency. But of course, that's not really accurate to what's going on in the world. And the Runa, like everyone, but the Runa specifically, are living in a world that is not just the world of some sort of pristine non-human forest. They're living in a world that has echoes of the colonial history that they've lived from the Spanish conquest on up to today. And so when they relate to the beings of the forest, in some ways the forest houses, holds all sorts of things, including all these layers of history. And this chapter is an attempt to sort of begin to really bring that stuff back in. I didn't want to bring it in right away. I mean, I allude to it, but because I wanted to go against the sort of anthropological move of always starting with complexity, of taking something, you know, oh, look, to understand anything, say the Runa, you have to understand their entire complete complex history, right? That's for me, like going back and looking at things in terms just of language. Because when you say complexity in that sense, you're saying one thing related to another thing, related to another thing in some sort of system of relations. So I was trying to sort of not do that up until now, where I feel like now that I have explained enough of these sorts of other things that are not, that don't have those properties, I can go back to bring some of this in. And the dog human relationship actually brings out many of the relationships that the Runa have with many other kinds of beings in a colonial history, especially with whites and non-indigenous peoples. So that's what I was trying to bring in. That chapter, and especially with this image of trans species pigeons, I'm bringing in some of those elements. That is to say that when people are interacting with their dogs, trying to talk to them, they're forced to sort of create a language, a shared language that is neither of the one or the other language, here in parentheses, a shared form of communication. And in some ways that is a pigeon. Both, and I mean that sort of in just the sense that it's two species that have to sort of communicate in some ways, but I also mean it in the more sort of historical sense, that this is a form of language that's usually coming together in colonial or colonially inflected context situations. So I want to bring that sort of awareness in, because it's so important to who the Runa are, that and to the problems they're facing, that that this is not just about the Runa and animals of the forest, but it's also the Runa in a historical context.
And it also, the way that this communicative strategy works also brings out the importance of the fact that all of these selves in this context are all in some way transforming, right? I mean, the fact of the communication in this example with the dogs being possible depends on altering the dogs in some way, right? Giving the dogs a certain kind of a drug substance. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And you're showing basically that in order to survive as a dog in Avila, the dog has to become human in literally,
right,
in an important way. So it's a really important reminder that we're not just talking about these static selves that just exist out there and are relating to each other as kind of, you know, as stable individuals, but they are transformative individuals that are transformed and transforming based on the relationality that they necessarily exist within. And so I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind.
And one thing that's so important in Amazonia, and it's such a sort of powerful mode of being, is sort of what you could call a shamanistic mode. The possibility that one can learn to actualize certain kinds of realities by finding ways to recognize the self in other kinds of beings, and this is extremely important, and it's something that sort of, it's a way of being, it's a form of politics that is in some ways foreign to us. And the funny thing about this chapter is that I'm exploring it by not so much in terms of the way in which the runa are shamans, but the ways in which they force their dogs to become shamans, right? Usually people become shamans to be able to enter the points of view of spirits. In this case, the chapter is about the ways in which the runa help their dogs become shamans so that they can enter the points of view of humans. But it's always about what can happen if you can actualize certain kinds of relationships that may not be always visible or apparent to you from your normal point of view. And that's a very sort of important sort of Amazonian way of sort of being.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So continuing along our consideration of the importance of dreams, the next chapter also begins with a dream. And it begins with recounting a puzzling dream that you had about a peccary that you experienced. And you use that dream to open up the larger issues of the chapter. Now, this chapter is all about, among other things, the anthropological significance of form. Mm-hmm. This is an absolutely fascinating concept and kind of work that you're doing here. And I think probably the best way of treating this is just to ask you to talk about it. So can you talk about your notion of form? What is it? How is it working here? And what do we need to understand about form as you're laying it out in this chapter, in order to understand something important about the larger arguments that you're making in the book?
Yeah, so in our normal sort of dualistic way of thinking about things, there's two kinds of objects or two kinds of entities that we're comfortable talking about. One is mind, human mind, and the other is thing. And throughout much of the book, I sort of chipped away at that dualism by expanding what we think of mind to the point where life and mind become synonymous, and mind therefore changes. And of course, I've developed a whole bunch of conceptual tools out of that, that things like constitutive absence or the sense that somehow images are at the heart of thought, and these kinds of things that I was talking about in the earlier chapters. But there's another sort of piece there's another piece to this, which is which has to do with form, the ways in which pattern or things that are sort of redundant tend to have their own sorts of properties. And this isn't necessarily alive, although life uses it all the time, and it's not thing-like either, but it requires thinking with, because it's so central to life and thought. So that's what this chapter explores. And I sort of get at it again with another dream, this one of my own, of trying to, I had a very profound experience with the pig, profound for me and perhaps for the pig, I don't know. But I had sort of a weird moment of sort of intersubjective encounter where I was looking at a pig in the eyes for a few moments in the forest. And I dreamt about this kind of intensely. And I won't get into the details of it, but in the dream, I had again a contact with that pig, except the pig now was not in the forest, but was in a kind of a ranch. It was on a farm, in a pen. And the point that I try to lay out there is why is it that I dreamt that way? And it turns out that that's a very common way in which people dream about the spirits of the forest. They see a kind of parallel between a formal parallel between the forest and all sorts of domestic spaces like ranches. And so that sort of forces me to get into why those spaces might be the same, and why is it that I might sort of start dreaming like others, even when I wasn't necessarily enculturated into their world. And my answer is that both the parallel between certain kinds of domestic spaces and certain kinds of forest spaces and the parallel and the fact that I can start dreaming like others has to do with understanding how formal resonances work and how forms propagate through different settings. So in fact, I kind of, my dreaming took on the form of Amazonian dreaming in the same way that the estates and these other kinds of farm-like situations, extractive economies of colonists in the Amazon take on the form in some ways of hunting, of the forest ecology itself. And I have a whole bunch of complicated explanations as to why that is. But the point is that somehow those kinds of propagations are what are at the heart of that chapter and the weird sort of effortless way in which these sorts of things happen. And they're not really alive. They're not thing-like. They're not mind-like. But they're form-like.
Mm-hmm. And they exist and they act upon the world.
Yeah, they exist, but they exist in a weird way in the sense that it's sort of like the difference between being hit by a wave and riding a wave, right? So you can be hit by a wave and be sort of convinced of the existence of the wave. And of course, in some ways, that wave is doing something to you. But being in the wave, nothing is happening, although you're in it. And so there's that's sort of the difference between being in form and outside of form is sort of, I explore in that chapter. And the epigraph of it is about a monastery and a Zen monk saying, the people outside the monastery can understand what's going on, can feel that something is happening, but those who are inside it never notice anything.
Right.
And that sort of weird kind of, it is the people who are outside of the monastery who feel its atmosphere. Those who are practicing actually do not feel anything. That's from Zen mind, beginner's mind. The sort of idea that what is it, being inside form is this weird sort of experience but it also has a kind of, it comes out in my ethnography. That's what it's like to be in the realm of the spirits, for example.
Mm-hmm. So it's sort of simultaneously effortless, but also shapes life experiences. Like it determines modes of living at the same time that the experience of being in form feels effortless.
Yeah, and it requires all this skill. Like, say you're a surfer, right? It's like, you know, to be riding the wave is in some ways effortless, but you got to be able to do a push-up, a big push-up to get up on the wave. You've got to have all sorts of skill and knowledge. I mean, it's the same sort of thing with hunters. Like, they're constantly harnessing form. Like, as I mentioned, they actually don't just go around the forest looking for animals. They know the patterns that attract animals, the patterns of fruiting trees, for example. They sort of know those shifting geometries because things fruit at different times of the year. It's not like in temperate regions where you just have the spring, right? So they know there's all these weird shifting geometries and people just know where to go. So they're harnessing form, but of course you need to walk great distances. You need to have all sorts of skill. So, and it's not just about being in form in some sort of Zen way. It's doing something with it, right?
Right.
They don't want to just go into the spirit realm. They want to come back with meat.
And this, for listeners, we'll move to the future in a moment.
Right.
But for listeners also who are interested in particular in the ways that you're engaging ideas of emergence here, there's also a really interesting set of points you're making in this chapter about forms being emergent, and you're showing kind of self-similarity across scale, which I don't know that you're using the term fractal, but it sort of brings to mind a kind of fractal way of thinking about.
That's right.
So there's a ton more we could talk about in this chapter, but I want to make sure we talk at least a little bit about chapter 6. Now, this chapter opens up by taking us into another dream. And here it's a dream of a hunter who dreams of a policeman wearing a shirt that's covered in hair clippings. And the significance of this is explored in great detail in the chapter. Now, the dream in this part of the book becomes a way of thinking again about the general problem of how to be a self within the ecology of Runa selves and perhaps beyond. And related to this way of thinking and related to this general problem is a larger point you're making here about the temporality of selfhood, sort of what it means to exist with time, in time, as time, as a self. Life here specifically, as you're arguing, involves the future bearing upon the present. So this seems to be a good place to get into this chapter and open it up a little bit. Can you talk about what's happening here in terms of the concept of the future? What kind of work is the future doing, and what do we need to understand about that to understand the kind of work that this chapter is doing?
Yes. So basically, again, I start with the riddle of a dream. And the dream is about what looked like a nightmare. A guy dreams that he's getting a haircut, and in sort of Amazonian sort of thinking about things, like getting a haircut means it means killing a pig, or that a pig is killed because the bristles, as you mentioned, alluded to, bristles sit on the person's shirt, like when you get a haircut and you get hair on your shoulders. And that's all, you know, that the thing was that the guy who dreamt this didn't know whether this meant that in the context of the dream, there's a policeman who comes up to him who has hair on his shoulders. So in the dream, he didn't know whether it was whether he, the dreamer, was the pig, which would be a terrible dream, right? Because he is now, again, in this predatory way of thinking about things, he has just confronted his predator, which in this case is a white policeman. In some ways, like a jaguar also, but actually was a white policeman in the dream. Or as it turned out, when he recalled this dream to me was later on in the day when he had just killed a pig himself in the forest. And he says, oh, actually, it turns out I thought I'd had a nightmare, but actually it was a good dream because I was the predator, which means that he was the white policeman. So the question here is sort of, in what ways does becoming... how is it that in some ways becoming this sort of white policeman, how is that central to survival? And there's a lot of sort of ethnography that has to be sort of explained here. I won't get into it, but very briefly, the spirits of the forest are beings that are sort of portrayed like white policemen, often thought of as whites. And the argument that I make through a variety of different sort of other channels in the chapter is that in some ways for this man to survive, he had to, in some ways, see himself through the medium of his dreams and the way in which the dream sort of connected to the reality of the forest, from the point of view of his future self in the future as the spirit. So, in some ways, he had to see himself sort of in form, in the form of the spirits, not being attacked by a spirit as if that the white or the spirit was killing him, but he had to sort of become the spirit who was the attacker. And that required a special relationship to the future. And one of the things I talk about there is how this sort of links ethnographically to how people think about time and the spirits, but also how it links to a way of seeing biology as constitutively always based on a kind of futurity. In some ways, all life and all signs are dependent on this weird sort of relationship with a future that's represented, right? So when a jaguar tries to pounce on a ngudi, a kind of wild rodent, that jaguar is not going to get anywhere by pouncing on where that ngudi is. The jaguar is going to have to sort of go guess in some ways where the ngudi will be. And it's that bringing into that future into the present, which you can see in lots of all over wherever there's life, you see this kind of a dynamic. It's the future position of the ngudi that becomes important to where the jaguar will be. And this is not does not necessarily require consciousness, but it's something that is central. The sort of the role that future plays in life is very important. And so that's what ultimately this chapter is about. But it's also not just, again, about life in the biological sense, although it is, but it's also about the psychic life. And it's about psychic survival, including survival in this dense ecology, which is not only a tropical biological ecology, which it is, of course, but it's also a dense densely layered historical ecology, where to survive means to find a place within the detritus of a colonial encounter.
Well, Eduardo, I've taken up a lot of your time. There's so much more about the book that we could talk about that we haven't had a chance to. And for example, I haven't asked you anything about the photographs, right?
Which,
the book is full of these really wonderful photographs that, similarly to the way the sound of a peccary you talk about in the context of being a sonic image. I mean, these photographs very much are visual images that are not just illustrations, right? I mean, you're doing a really important kind of, I think, narrative work in dialogue with the written prose. That's very, very effective. So there's a ton that we could talk about the book. It's extraordinarily rich. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Well, I just wanted to say, maybe just in 2 seconds, just expand on what you just said about the images.
Sure.
In some ways, the point of the book is that forests do think, and that sort of thinking is available to us. So the question is not just sort of making the claim that forests think. The point is to say, you too can think like forests. You too can think in this sort of imagistic way. And these photos are intended to do this. It's the sort of thinking that forests do through images. And the point is, and this is something I don't necessarily underscore, I do say it in the book, but I want to say it sort of more forcefully, is that this is a kind of thinking that we need to learn to do in the Anthropocene. We live now in a world in which humans are forces of nature. And we had part of what we're doing is we're changing that. We're thinking forests are under threat, but in part because we are in some ways perhaps, I don't want to be romantic about it. I don't want to say exactly that we've forgotten how to think with forests, but I'm convinced that the solutions to our problems will somehow come from our abilities that we already have inside us to think with and like forests.
Well, thank you. This is it's an extraordinarily moving book. It's been a very, very provocative and moving conversation for me. And congratulations on the book. I think this is a field changer. I mean, this is going to be something that's does now and is going to continue to really make a difference. So now that the book is out, what's next for you? Speaking of futures, is there any project or are there any projects that are currently inspiring you?
Yes. In fact, this builds on the same question of images in the Anthropocene. The two sort of areas, there's, I guess, three areas where I'm moving. One is to think, to actually methodologically think with images. Along with my partner and colleague, Lisa Stevenson, we have been making ethnographic films, and we're continuing to do this. And the idea there is, how can we actually put into practice a form of ethnography which is non-discursive? That is, not just write about it, but actually do it. And image making is the way to do that. So that's one area. The other area that I'm working on is, again, on taking this sort of thinking forest idea and actually moving more concretely to questions of the Anthropocene and thinking about how to think in with the Anthropocene in practical political ways, because I do think that these are the stakes for our projects. And then the final thing that I'm doing, which is a bit perhaps more short term, is to think in some ways the way I introduced this this interview is I said that in some ways this book is a reaction to the linguistic turn. Well, one could say that this book is then also part of what might be called the ontological turn, mm-hmm. In scholarship, to think beyond human realities as we know them. And so one of my goals right now is to think about that in more sort of explicit ways, comparing other similar sort of ontological projects and sort of being, try to say something more general about what sort of this ontological turn is about.
That's fabulous. I have a feeling we're going to be talking in much more and much greater length about some of these projects in the future.
Yes.
In the meantime, thank you so much, Eduardo. It's really been a pleasure. And I'm just so thrilled to have had a chance to read the book and talk with you about it.
Thanks so much, Carla. And thanks so much for your wonderful questions and your patience to sit with it.
Yeah. You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks for joining us. And we'll look forward to seeing you next time.